Earlier this year, we reported on a movement to confront historical acts of racial terror in a place you might not expect. Horrific lynchings occurred after the Civil War in the Deep South and the former Confederacy, but also in many border states, including Maryland. As special correspondent Brian Palmer reported, Maryland is now the first state to undertake a formal truth and reconciliation process to reckon with its painful and violent history. We'll speak with a historian about that, but we begin our update with an excerpt from our June report, which we need to warn you includes graphic descriptions of violence. The story is part of our ongoing series exploring hate, anti-Semitism, racism, and extremism.
In the center of downtown Salisbury on Maryland's eastern shore, the historic Wicomico County Courthouse stands today as it did in 1931. Back then, this supposed Hall of Justice was the site of a brutal extrajudicial killing, the lynching of 23-year-old Matthew Williams.
You know, he was a normal child. I mean, he played with his cousins. He loved going to watch pictures. And during the Depression, he had money in two bank accounts. He had a stable job, was employed, and was able to maintain employment.
Charles Chavis Jr. is a historian at George Mason University and the author of the forthcoming book, The Silent Shore: The Lynching of Matthew Williams and the Politics of Racism in the Free State. The horrific lynching of Matthew Williams was reported widely at the time, including in the Afro-American, a black-owned paper in nearby Baltimore. While there are differing accounts of what happened that day, what we do know is that Williams worked for a wealthy white business owner in Salisbury. After an altercation, Williams' boss was dead, and Williams himself suffered several gunshot wounds but was still alive. Once word got out, a white mob formed at the hospital where he had been taken. The nurse in charge of the segregated black ward reportedly stepped aside to allow his abduction.
There's a famous quote that's actually published in the Baltimore Sun where she says, "If you're going to take him quietly."
The injured Williams was thrown from a hospital window and dragged several blocks to the courthouse. The white mob tortured, hanged, and then burned his body. The crime was captured in this drawing that ran in the Baltimore Morning Sun.
Williams was not only lynched on the courthouse lawn, but his body was taken after, when it was burned, to the black section of Salisbury, put on display for onlookers to drive by while the local police department directed traffic.
No one has ever been held accountable for his killing.
Matthew Williams is buried somewhere in this cemetery, his grave unmarked. But after nearly 90 years since the lynching of this black man, the city of Salisbury is beginning to acknowledge its history of white racial violence.
When the mob came for him, they faced little resistance.
On a recent Saturday, a group of several dozen people gathered to retrace the path that the mob took as it dragged Williams to his death. From the hospital where he was kidnapped, still a medical center, across the Wicomico River to the courthouse lawn. The occasion was the unveiling of a sign memorializing Williams, an unidentified black man found beaten to death a day later and believed to be a victim of the same mob, and Garfield King, an 18-year-old black man lynched in the county in 1898.
Today marks the 90th anniversary of the brutal lynching of Matthew Williams and the second man also believed to be a victim of the same white mob. Charles Chavis, assistant professor at George Mason University and the vice chair of Maryland's Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission, joined us again for more on the work being done in the state. Charles, tell me, what is the significance? I mean, it's symbolic, but why the marker in Salisbury? Why is it important?
These are acts of symbolic reconciliation, and we see them as being a first step in a number of steps that have to take place in order for communities to heal. And in Salisbury, where the Lynching Memorial Task Force has established this marker, it's so important that it is right there on the courthouse lawn where the act actually took place.
I know the state Maryland Lynching Truth and Reconciliation Commission, you've started doing public hearings, so to speak. Now, you can't retry the case or the crime. You can't provide justice, so to speak, for the descendants of those people who were lynched. But what are those meetings like, or what are you hoping to get from them?
So the meetings are deeply powerful, not only for those who witness it, but most importantly for the victims, the descendants of the victims, in which we've had the honor of connecting with and providing them with the space to share the story of their loved ones.
You went into this process and began researching the death of Matthew Williams, whose the anniversary, the unfortunate anniversary, is 90 years ago now. 90 years actually doesn't seem like that far ago, a long time ago, when we think of the word lynchings.
I hope that it dispels the myth that these things, that lynchings took place at the hands of persons unknown. I titled my books, A Silent Shore, because there's a myth of silence. What I'm able to uncover in the book is that white members of the community talked about this openly amongst themselves. We know that this lynching, the lynching of Matthew Williams, like most lynchings, was a state-sanctioned lynching, where you had state's attorneys and local law enforcement officers all complicit and culpable in the lynching of Matthew Williams. And there's still a silence, even 90 years later, that is palpable in this community. And it's very important for us to understand that if we're going to move forward and break the silence, then the truth has to be validated. And we have to make sure that those who are continuing to experience this have their opportunity to speak truth to power. One other thing is important to understand. Ms. Shaney Shields, who's a Salisbury activist, she mentions that, you know, one of the reasons why people didn't speak up is because they worked for the family members of those who were involved. And to this day, some of those family members still hold power over this community. And there's still that power dynamic at play, which speaks to the continued silence even 90 years later.
Charles Chavis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Charlie, for having me.
For more, including an essay from Charles Chavis, please check out the Exploring Hate website, pbs.org/exploringhate.